A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, we had a great conversation with Elizabeth Pedersen. She's incredible. She's a former youth in care who has a great lived experience in the foster care space. She's advocating. She's helping other people to advocate. Just a phenomenal conversation. I know you're going to enjoy it like I did. Let's get proximate. Welcome back to First Lady and Friends. We have an amazing guest. We've already been giggling, so we are ready to go. This is my new friend, Elizabeth Pedersen, affectionately known as Lizzie.
Yes,
She's so great. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Just so excited to have you. We met a few months ago when we were connected through an organization, and you have an incredible story. So I would like you to just kind of start from the beginning and talk about your story growing up and your experiences and how you got to where you are right now.
Yeah, I grew up in Minnesota. I grew up in a suburb like about 15 minutes from Minneapolis called Bloomington, Minnesota. And I spent 14 years there. So that's where I claim to be from. That's home to me. I came from a single mom, so I don't have a relationship with my biological dad, but my single mom, she did great. She did great for so many years. And as any single mother does, they struggle in capacities that a lot of families can't understand, can't comprehend. And so to all the single mothers out there, like, you're doing a great job. We love you. Keep rocking it. Came to a point when I was about 12 or 13, where just the situation was kind of child welfare got involved, and we were kind of evaluating, okay, what is the best interest for Elizabeth, for me? And that I stayed with some family friends for a few months, and the legality of staying with them and being enrolled in school and not being able to go to the doctor because they don't have legal permission or rights over me kind of took over, and I was placed into the foster care system, where I tell people back then, it probably, I wouldn't have said it was the best 10 and a half months of my life. Looking back, it was the best 10 and a half months of my life. I was placed with the best family, only one family. I stayed in my same school district. So I stayed around the same people, the same friends. I was like 2.5 minutes from where I grew up with my mom. So it was really just a blessing in disguise that I was placed where I was placed. And I still have a relationship with those foster parents today and their biological son. So, yeah, that was really neat. I had an incredible guardian at Lydum. I had a lot of people in the foster care system that really fought for me and fought for my voice. And my guardian at Lydum was so gifted at empowering my voice and not speaking for me. And she was the one who really kind of just came in and was like, no, like, you're smart, advocate for yourself. And I have my grandfather, who's been a part of my whole life and practically half raised me. He has also always said, you're so strong-willed, you have a good head on your shoulders. And I really have just kind of blossomed on those words, which have been really just a gift. And so after I left the foster care system, my aunt and uncle adopted me. They live in Salt Lake City. So I made the trek out here, over 1,000 miles away from what was home. And yeah, I started freshman year here, and then I graduated, and I moved to Boise. So there's a lot of ins and outs to those 18 years. But that is kind of my story, how I was placed in care, being adopted out of care. Stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a really incredible story of resilience and really having that powerful voice. And I think that's what first, you know, I think it was such a, you know, your voice and your personality is such a force that, I mean, I was immediately drawn in and we've had some incredible conversations. One of the things that, you know, in our work in foster care and this space is really, you know, there are so many people with this lived experience, and this you and I have talked about this, and you're a lived experience expert.
Yeah.
And so, you know, talk maybe just a little bit about how and when you decided you could use your voice to be this lived experience expert. Mm-hmm. And, you know, were people receptive to that right away or did it take some time?
Yeah. I think ever since I was little, I've always been very strong-willed. I'm an only child. And so I kind of had the personality from a very young age. It was my way or the highway. Mm-hmm. Which we've learned to navigate that in a healthy way. We've learned that control in type A is not always the best way. But I think honestly, like having that from such a young age and honestly gaining the independence from such a young age, I mean, people who grow up with single moms, they gain a certain independence. You know, you kind of have to fend for yourself a little bit more than a 2-to-1 ratio, right? And so, that kind of definitely sparked that voice and just being heard and being an only child and being the first child in my family for years. There was a lot of attention. There was a lot of like, well, what does the little girl want to do? What does Lizzie want to do? This, and this. And so that kind of, I think, sparked that. And then when I went through everything that I did, it took quite a few years of processing, quite a few years of really diving deep to the root of hurt, handling forgiveness, forgiving things that, you know, your own family goes through is really hard because there's a lot of love there, but there's also a lot of hurt. And so balancing the two of those was really difficult. But I think just over the years, I really took time in my high school years and about 2 years after high school when I moved to Boise for college to just kind of like dive into the root of the pain and how do we overcome that pain, but we use it for someone else, you know, like someone else needs to hear the same story and someone else needs to understand that like there's light at the end of the tunnel.
No, it's so powerful and it's so needed. And do you attribute maybe that, you know, you talked a little bit about how, you know, you're an only child, and maybe that environment helped you to kind of, you know, that having to be independent at a young age. How much of it is that, and how much of it is necessity to have to have overcome some of this stuff, and versus this is just my personality, and I would have survived this anyway, or something like I'm not survived it anyway, but that,
no, totally,
but I mean like. Because there's people with a lot of different personalities that maybe wouldn't have thrived as well as you did in a situation that you were in.
No, totally. And I think there's something to be said about just like it is, you know, partially personality, partially being strong-willed. And it's also partially like just having to I think for many years, and I still probably have a little bit of this in me, if I don't do it, it's not going to get done. Mm-hmm. Or if I don't do it, it's not going to be done well. And I think part of that was kind of growing up, like from a very young age, I was like signing my field trip papers and stuff like that, because I was like, I have to do that, you know? And then I moved in when my aunt and uncle adopted me and they were like, kids don't do that. And I was like, you can't untrain 14 years of that. Like, and it was honestly probably one of the hardest things for us is because they were like, be a kid. And I was like, I don't know how.
Yeah.
And so, I think, it's part personality, but it's part just kind of like learned, through the years of what you're kind of like taught to do. You know, some kids are really strongly dependent. Mm-hmm. And their parents create a space for that. Mine didn't. So.
That's so interesting.
Navigate.
You talked about your aunt and uncle, and I can imagine that was there were probably some growing pains, some learning pains. Yeah. And I mean, I hear a lot of stories youth in care who almost create problems, not necessarily intentionally, but as a proof, like, of course they're going to send me away because that's what I've experienced.
It's the, like, unshakable stability that your adoptive parents, your foster parents offer. Kids who don't grow up in that environment don't think that's normal. So, like, they, you know, a lot of people are like, well, foster care is just a bunch of troubled kids, and there's a stigma around that. And I'm like, no, it's not troubled kids. It's not kids seeking attention. It's kids who need to relearn what stable is. They've never been taught what stability is. They've never been taught what having a two-parent household is. They've never been taught food on the table and clothes on your back is normal. And so they act out almost in this sense of, like, how far will my new parent's love stretch for me until it doesn't, you know? And I think a lot of foster parents, I know a lot of foster parents who their love has been stretched, you know, but it's like, your own child could act out in that same way and you would fight for them. And so you would fight for their stability. You would fight for their normalcy. You would get them help in whatever capacity they needed it. So why don't we do that for foster kids?
Yeah, no, it's so great. And I think just a thought as we go into this, and as a thought for, you know, prospective foster families, for prospective kinship families, who may, you know, if they have an understanding of that trauma informed, you know, you understand that this child has had this type of trauma, then it doesn't make them a bad kid. It doesn't make them a horrible person, which is, you know, crazy that that's, you know, can be a stigma. But that this child is having to learn what love and connection feels like. And with that looming, I think, idea that this could go away too. And I'm waiting to see how far it takes for it to go away.
Yeah. And it's just something that kids should never have to worry about being taken away. Like, love is not, parents' stability is not something that should be even in question for children.
Yes.
That should just be a known that kids will have that. And I think one of the best things my aunt and uncle did when I moved in is they put me immediately into therapy, which a lot of people would be like, well, duh. But really, I mean, a good therapist. And I was with her for 3 to 4 years, and she was so good at navigating, like, this is an attachment style. What is your attachment style with parents? What is your attachment style with friends? You know, are you anxious? Are you secure? Most kids in the quote-unquote normal family have a secure attachment style. They know their parents aren't going anywhere. They know their parents love them, and they know their parents would do anything for them. Most foster kids have an anxious attachment style where they will do anything to push you away until you prove that you will not leave through any of it. So that also was just so interesting to, and that was honestly really helpful because my aunt and uncle, they're not mental health professionals, you know, they're professionals in a completely different field of work, but they were like, we don't know. Like, just because we're your parents now doesn't mean we can help you in this way, but let us get you help.
Yeah. I love that. You know, that's such a great thought. And even anybody who, you know, has children, I mean, I myself as a parent have to do that when there's a problem that I can't solve. Yeah. I'm not a mental health professional.
Yes. Yeah.
I know my husband in his ecclesiastical roles, you know, he would have people come to him and he's like, I'm not a mental health professional. Let me help you find someone who is. And I think we make the mistake because we're a parent, we should know about attachment styles or, you know, these things that somebody's going through, even if there hasn't been the type of trauma you're talking about. I mean, life is really hard for a lot of people, and there's some mental health struggles that we're all going to face. So I love that therapy and professionals are needed, and they know what they're doing.
Yeah, they know a lot better turns than parents out, sometimes. Yeah.
Turns out. Yeah. when we come right back, I want to talk about our trip to D.C. We'll do that when we come right back.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
We're back here with Elizabeth Pedersen. We've had a great conversation so far, and she's just, you can tell why we connected. She's amazing. You're amazing.
Thank you.
But we had a great trip to Washington, D.C. together.
We did.
And so
it was a party.
It was a total party. But we did a lot of work.
Yeah.
Just we get
clarity
that straight. But so talk a little bit about, you know, from your perspective, you know, why we went, what was our purpose of our trip, and then we can talk about some of our really cool experiences.
Yeah, well, I got a phone call one day. It was like noon, and I was like, I don't know who this is, but it's a Utah number. I'll answer it, whatever. And it was one of your assistants, and she was like, hey, is this Elizabeth? And I was like, uh-huh. Like, what's up? Like, what did I either did something really wrong or really right. And so she was like, yeah, so we've actually been invited to go to Washington, D.C. next week, you know, for foster care and youth mental health. And we are allowed to bring a lived experience person with us. Would you like to be that? And I was like, I guess. Like, sure, maybe. And in the first round, I had missed, she said, next week. So I was like, oh, when? Thinking, you know, like 6 months from now. Everything with the government is planned super far out. And she goes, oh, you'll leave in like 4 days. And I was like,
what?
Oh, yeah. I was like, okay, sure. Sounds fun. I guess we're going to D.C. And so I freaked out, packed my bags, thought, what an opportunity. And as you know, it just kind of like went up from there.
Yeah.
We had the craziest time.
Yeah. So I'll set it up and I'll let you finish the story because it was so great. For whatever reason, that came together so quickly. Usually travel like that is on my calendar way ahead of time, but we were invited to come back to it was a conference put on by the Casey Family Foundation, which is an organization that does a lot around foster care and youth mental health and child welfare in general. And so, we thought it was a great opportunity because it was also with, other first spouses. There were about five of us there, I think, that ended up coming, and five of us that kind of have been working in the space of child welfare and youth mental health and things like that. I've spoken before on the program about, Tammy Murphy, the first lady of New Jersey, who came out like a month ago, working on youth mental health and maternal health. And so we've connected, my colleagues and I across the country have connected a few of us on these ideas. And so when they asked me to come back, I made it work in the schedule because I thought this was really an important convening. And to bring people with lived experience with us, I thought was really powerful.
Absolutely,
I think one of the phrases that I've heard, and I think it was there that I heard this, and I can't stop thinking about it in everything that I do. And it's called "Nothing for us without us." And I, you know, it's informed my work in with unified sports, with the Special Olympics. I mean, that's a big theme. I think anytime we're working with any group, we need to make sure that those voices are the decision makers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So with your voice and your colleagues in that conference, I thought it was really powerful to hear those stories. We were able to meet with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, I mean, cabinet level for the federal government. It was a really big deal. So we had a really cool experience where, you know, the night we flew in or the afternoon we flew in, they said, we'll set up a tour of the White House, which isn't unusual, which was really fun. And I thought that'll be great. You know, these former youth, these young adults are going to love this. And yeah. I've been to the White House once before and had a really interesting experience there. Yeah. It was really great. So I thought, well, this will be really cool. So just as we were about to get there, somebody told me that the Marine One, the president's helicopter, had left a few hours before to go down to Florida to visit the hurricane sites and that kind of thing. So I had understood that they had gone there. And so when we pulled up to the White House and we get in there and we do the COVID test and we do all this stuff, and they take us right up to the balcony, which I thought was really weird. And then all of a sudden we're sitting out there and you
Here
tell
comes
the rest
Joe.
Of the story.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, okay. Secret Service, you know, was like, the president's flying in. You guys can watch him land. And I was like, this is a sack of baloney. Like, we're not going to do this.
That's what I thought. I thought it would be like a mile away. We'd see him like.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, little green dot in the sky. Hey, Joe. Like, what's up? Yeah. And then all of a sudden, we saw the news reporters. And we had the best view. We were on the balcony overseeing the landing pad. And the news reporters and stuff were under us. But yeah, when I saw them come, I was like, oh, he's like, actually, he's coming home. Like, we're in his house. That's when it kind of hit me that I was at the White House. I was like,
you weren't just at this historical building. This was the actual White House.
At first, it felt a little historical. I was like, all the security precautions, all the COVID testing, you know, like checking bags, everything. And then, you know, you walked quietly through the hallways. I was like, oh, I just feel like I'm at a museum for the former presidents. I don't know. And then, yeah, so we went to the balcony. I made sure I ran to the edge of that balcony. Yeah. I was like, if Joe's going to come, I'm going to be the first to see him. And so I secured my spot, stood there, and then all of a sudden it got windier and windier and windier. And I was like, oh, that's a helicopter is coming in full force. We are about to see the president. So the helicopter lands again, so windy. I was like, I've never been that close to a helicopter. Didn't realize.
I mean, we're like 50 feet.
Yes. So close.
From the helicopter
so
landing.
Close. Everyone's preparing. They roll out his like magic carpet thing so he doesn't have to walk on the grass. Jill's heels don't have to get in the grass. And then here comes Joe and Jill off the helicopter. So kind. They wave to us, whatever. And I'm just in awe. I'm like.
And we're thinking they'll get whisked off and we
totally.
Get.
Totally. They have their
they
separate
get a little,
entrance.
Yeah. We get a little wave.
Yep, I did my queen wave. I was like, hey. They had a separate entrance down below us. And then all of a sudden, everyone else went there and we see Joe come up the stairs. And I was like, oh my gosh. This is insane. He came around. He shook all of our hands. You fought for us to get a picture of him shaking our hands. Y'all, our first lady fights for us. Let me tell you.
We were like, I was like big time paparazzi because I'm like, I'm going to get a picture of my girls.
Yeah. All, you know, the security was like, okay, let's go inside. Let's go inside. We'll get a group picture. And then, you know, First Lady Abby was like, no, you stay with me. Like, we'll get you your picture. And I was like, okay, I'm listening to my state. Sorry, security.
As we get tackled to the ground.
Yeah. I was like, I'm going to get this picture. And I sure did. I got.
I know. I said to you, because they were like trying to shoo us inside.
Yeah.
And because of my previous experience at the White House, where I again ran into Joe Biden.
Yes.
Weirdly.
Yeah.
I like thought, no, I know he's going to come over here and I know he's going to shake hands. So I said to you, I said, don't go and stay right by me. Yes, stay right by
me.
Yes. I said, and he did. And he came and he shook hands and we got pictures.
He did. Yeah.
And it was really cool.
We got pictures out there. We walked inside, got more pictures, group pictures. And then he went to go eat and probably go to bed. He was probably exhausted. And we said goodbye.
He did mention on the balcony, he said something like, well, I got this thing, because I don't know if you heard. I think it was when he was talking to us.
I was just in shock.
He said, I got this thing, you know, North Korea just shot some missiles over Japan. I was like, well, maybe you should go take care of that. Yeah. I was
like, oh, dear. Just things of the president. I like watched him hold his phone and I was like, the president has a phone. Like, I knew he had a phone, but like watching the president of the United States hold the same iPhone that you have.
Yeah. Yeah,
casually. I was like, you're a human. Yeah. You are in human form right now.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think that's what's cool. And I mean, I think anytime I've had an experience with, you know, people like that, that are, you know, and I haven't had a ton of experience like that, but, you know, or celebrities or something like that, I think my experience is always like, I mean, I know we say, of course they're humans, but they really are humans. Yeah. And for me, always, almost always, the lesson is they really are, people really are kind and nice.
Yes.
And people that you see in the media, you know, you may still disagree with them politically, or you may disagree with them, you know, in other ways, or you may not think their decisions are the right ones. But, you know, having the grace to understand that we're all, you know, most people are really good.
Yeah.
And they're trying to do the best they can with the knowledge they have and their experiences and their worldview. And so for me, it's always been a really great experience to get to know people that maybe are in that realm of sort of celebrity types where you're like, they're good people.
Yeah.
People are good.
Very kind. Yeah. 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 I remember when he asked me my name and he like didn't hear it at first and he like clarified to make sure he had it right. And I was like, Joe knows my name. Like, that's about as far as I'll get. But he heard my name and he said it out of his mouth. We've made it. We're doing it. This is great.
Yeah. It was, and to have that moment with you guys, I think that was just really cool.
Yeah.
So we did more than just visit the White House. We did end up having this really incredible conversation with some cabinet leaders in the White House cabinet. So talk a little bit about your experience presenting to the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Yeah. Emotional. It's really, really just very formative to talk to someone that high in power that is actually listening to you. It's one of those things where it's like, I know the general public will hear my story and be like, wow, you're incredible. Good job. We love you. See ya. You know, but just to have like designated time to share my story, my thought process behind things, what we're trying to do in the state of Utah, and also hear from other lived experience young adults. I mean, that was the first time I've ever sat in a room with people my age who have the same experience. And it was really powerful. It was people that could connect on a totally different level with me. They understand the foster care system. They understand broken relationships in your family. They understand like really all of it. You know, they might not know you as a day-to-day person, but they understand the deep growing pains of what we've gone through. And so it was just really incredible to hear their stories and kind of get insight to like what they're doing in their states. Like you had mentioned, we had 5 states with us. And so all of it was just incredible. And yeah, being able to share our voices was really impactful.
Yeah. And I do have to say, I know I'm a little biased, but seriously, you were a rock star.
Thank you.
I mean, it was powerful. And there were, you were by far, you know, and our other lived experience expert that was with us, you two were by far the most articulate, the most, it wasn't just emotional, but it was powerful emotion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was vulnerable. And I mean, everybody was vulnerable, and I'm not trying to compare
totally.
Or whatever,
yeah.
because everybody has their strengths and different, but it was your testimony that I felt were the most,
receptive.
Connected
yeah.
with and, yeah. and receptive to, because I mean, you had them come up to you after and they wanted to know more.
Yeah.
And you were articulate and brilliant in, mm-hmm. in those testimonies. And so I think it was really powerful.
Well, and I feel like being in that space, it's like, that's a one-time shot, you know,
yes.
like you don't get to like just redo that if you mess up. And so I was like, you guys have to understand that you make these decisions and you're in these meetings, but like people actually live these lives, and like
yep.
you're advocating for those tears, you're advocating for the kids who don't have a mom and dad, like you're advocating for the voiceless. That's how I feel
yeah.
is I'm like, there are so many kids in our system in America, over 400,000, and I'm like, it is my job to advocate for those who do not feel like they have a voice
yep.
or empower their voice, give them like a reason to speak up in yeah. their situations
yeah. And you're uniquely positioned to do that. I mean, I can go try to advocate, and I will, and I do.
Yeah.
But it's not nearly as effective.
Yeah.
When it comes from somebody that hasn't had the lived experience.
Totally. Yeah.
And when you can be the voice for people that are literally in a situation now that you experienced.
Yeah. Yeah. And helping them, like, I can look at her, a physical human being who has gone through a similar story, who has dealt with the same welfare system, and she's made it across the bridge.
Yes.
You know, trying to be that person. Obviously, yeah. I've struggled. It has not
right.
been a perfect line, but being someone people can look at and say, I can do it.
Yeah.
Like, I can make it. I don't need to go to jail. I don't need to not go to college because I don't believe in myself. No, you can do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Ugh. It's so, so powerful, and we all felt it in the room, and
yeah.
so it was really amazing. I want to kind of get into what's next for you.
Yes.
And what plans you have, and we'll do that when we come right back. We're back here with Elizabeth Pedersen. She is obviously a dear friend of mine now, and I know all of you feel the vibe that she's giving off. She's amazing, and we've had such a great time. I want to talk about, let's talk about what you're doing currently, because mm-hmm. I think it's pretty amazing. Again, like everything that you do is amazing. So mm-hmm. talk a little bit about where you are right now.
I'm a CASA for the state of Utah. So
Awesome.
We need them. Here's
and talk
little
a little
plot.
Bit about what that is.
Yeah. So it's a court appointed special advocate. So basically, I build relationships with kids that I help advocate for. So sometimes the judge will ask you to speak in court on behalf of the child. A lot of times the guardian ad litem does that. But my position is really unique because I actually get to build that one-on-one relationship with the child. Even if I have a sibling set, I still have the option to take each kid out one-on-one and do an activity with them. And I think it's unique because it really does help solidify what I want for these children, and that is to empower their own voice. I don't want to be their voice. I don't want to speak on behalf of them. I want them to find their voice and have me come alongside and help them articulate and help them find that deeper power within them that I know they can find and push for that. Obviously, there's cases a three-year-old is not going to know how to articulate perfectly in court, and I'm happy to come in and assist. But with my older kids, I really do try to come alongside them and say, like, what do you need? What do you want? And allow them and create a space for them to process that every month when I see them, and just have them learn how to say what they want. A lot of kids are really shy and timid in speaking their voice, even when it comes to, like, do you want to go to McDonald's or Wendy's? They can't make that decision. They can't speak on behalf of themselves in something as simple as that. So it makes it even harder in the court system. So I'm working on that. And being a CASA is one of the greatest things in the world.
Yeah.
Like, I just,
and anybody can do it, right?
I mean, anyone can do it. You go through a training. You go through a six-week training. And anyone can do it. And it really, a lot of people think it takes up so much time. It's 5 to 10 hours a month. So it's nothing. It really is nothing.
It's nothing for you. It's everything to them.
Everything for them. Yeah. And it's that one safe, steady person. You know, I always tell people who aren't ready to foster and they're not ready to adopt, I say, be a CASA. Build relationship with kids in tragedy and show them triumph. Like, bring them to the other side. Watch them walk to the other side. Because it's remarkable. And it's really the resilience you learn, the joy you find in them. I mean, our minor inconveniences day to day have nothing to do. I mean, I just, they're incredible.
Yeah.
They're incredible. And to think that I went through that 11 years ago, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's insane.
Yeah. And for them to be able to look at you and say, I mean, I say everyone can do it, and you can. I think it's very special when people who with lived experience will do it because, again, that special connection that, no, I really do get what you're going through. Yeah. I really do.
Yeah.
And you have a unique empathy that you can employ to help those kids. So, yeah, I love that you're doing that. That's not all you do. What else do you do?
That's all I do. I manage Is So Delicious. That's my little, that's my 2 cents. I like texted our CEO yesterday. I said, can I say So Delicious? And he was like, yeah, represent, like, go for it, you know? Yeah. So I work with that. I manage a team of kids there. Also one of my greatest joys. I'm also working on creating a team of people in the Salt Lake area to be lived experience advocates. And really formulating and building that from the ground up has been really unique to foster and build relationships with people in all sorts of different communities and just really find a great team of lived experience experts for our Salt Lake area to help with policy hearings, to come and represent the lived experience life, to speak at conferences. I've spoken at so many conferences. I'm speaking at another one this Saturday, and just getting our voices out there because they're so needed. So needed.
Yes. And the voices of hope, I think, is the biggest thing, because I think we look at the child welfare system and we see a lot of brokenness in a lot of times we do. It's just hard. I mean, the more I get to know people and experiences and caseworkers and families and individuals, like, it can be really overwhelming for me.
Yeah.
And so when you dive into this, it feels like sometimes you're like, oh, it's too much. Yeah. It's too hard.
Yeah.
We can't fix this, and we can't fix everybody.
Well, there's so many moving roles to it.
Yes.
I mean, if anyone listening has foster care experience, you know, like, your kid has like 9 workers, and that's not even the extent of it. I mean, like, it just, the list goes on. And so trying to not overwork social workers and caseworkers and therapists and stuff stepping into these positions as, you know, their professional experience, but really trying to find people with the lived experience that have the passion, that have the empathy to who they're speaking to. And allowing them to be that voice. I'm really excited for it.
Yeah, I love it. You're the perfect advocate. What else is new for you? And what do you see down the pipe?
I'm graduating with my bachelor's of psychology in May. So I'm
congratulations.
Kind of, thank you. I'm kind of in that weird season of like, okay, what do I want to do? Yeah. Do I want to go and work in the system? Do I want to just use my voice for passion and not my profession? That is the one I'm leaning to the most. I would love to get a little bit more involved with all the circles of people that are really impacting the Utah foster care system and kind of see where I can help. The lived experience model is something that's very new. It hasn't been around for a long time. And so I know, you know, the committee that we're creating together, and then there's a couple other ones, they don't have lived experience individuals. It's like social workers, and it's panels of people that work in it but don't necessarily have lived experience in it. And so kind of navigating those conversations and building that networking and kind of seeing, you know, where do I see myself landing, whether it's a job or not. I'm not opposed to just volunteering in all aspects of the world and hoping that I get a job doing something using my degree, but
actually getting paid and whatnot.
Actually getting paid one day. Yeah. Yeah. But really networking and finding, finding vulnerable youth, finding the ones that are aging out. I mean, trying to create, I'm in the process of building a website for teenage youth and their lack of resources. How do you interview for a job? How do you fill out a job application? How do you fill out FAFSA for college? And so I'm building a website, obviously, in my little to no free time. So it's taken quite a few months to like get up and going. It's almost done. But just with that information, with like how to budget, how to meal prep, where to go grocery shopping for like your best deals, how to, you know, recipes that are like good, delicious meals that are easy for single people. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of creating a base for people to go to, who have aged out of foster care or foster parents to go to, and using it as a tutorial to teach these kids. That's something I wish was around when I aged out. I'm like, every kid needs that, foster care or not. Like, I didn't know how to grocery shop. I can't tell you how many times I called my aunt in the grocery store aisle. What aisle is flour on? And she was like, Lizzie, just keep walking. Like, you'll find it. Like, there's only so many aisles in the grocery store. But yeah, so in the process of building that and just kind of seeing what'll flourish from that and the conversations that'll be started. I think that's what means the most to me is the one-on-one intentional time with people, learning stories or being able to advocate on behalf of the teens that I was just a few years ago.
Yeah. Oh, so great. Like I say, and now all the listeners know why you and I are besties now because you're amazing.
Yeah. Maybe I'll create a podcast. I don't know.
Yes. Yes. I think she would be perfect. Yes. She would be the perfect person for a podcast. What's the main thing? Like if somebody was just hanging around and now I have, Show Up has, you and I have some things in the works.
Yes. Yes.
And we have some things in the works with our interfaith community and making sure that we're setting up care communities.
Absolutely.
This is coming, folks.
Yeah.
So make sure that you're watching for it. But
it's going to be big.
It's huge. It really is big. And Lizzie and I are collaborating on this idea and she's going to be a big part of what we're doing going forward with Show Up and foster care. In the meantime, maybe if you could plant some seeds about a CASA is one thing. What are some other like desperate needs that somebody if say, hey, look, I want to get my family involved in doing some service. I'm now realizing that this is a need. What are some other ways that somebody could get involved in helping in the foster care space?
Totally. A lot of it is meals. Like we've created meal trains for families, foster families who take in crisis kids and are up all night and they just need dinner the next night. They just need a pan of lasagna and kind of equipping and setting people up for that. I mean, you're doing it for your own family. Put it in the oven for another family. That's a really easy, tangible one. We're also collecting a lot of donations for Utah foster care, really trying to set these kids, these teenagers who are about to age out for success. So what that looks like is anything for the home, kitchen utensils, pots, pans, vacuums. I mean, like, you name it, they probably need it. Teenage clothing, clean out your closets. Like, we all have clothing that we don't want, we don't wear. Donate to Utah foster care instead of Savers or the DI. Those are great places, but we have teens and older kids who are in a deep need of clothing and items. They leave the system with nothing. You know, a lot of kids are sent off to college with a dorm room with bedding and all that stuff, and these kids aren't. Yeah. So doing that for them, just really circling around if you know a family who's a foster family, providing like a date night, have your little 14-year-old child babysit their kids. You know, in the state of Utah, we're really lucky that if the parents trust them as a sitter, the state trusts them as a sitter. And so it's a lot easier to navigate date nights or someone to watch the kid or someone to run the child to an appointment.
Yeah.
A lot of, I mean, they're booked with appointments all week long, plus school.
Yeah, you talked about these nine people in their lives. I mean, those are court appointments. Those are therapy appointments. Those are doctor's appointments, wellness checks,
social worker prepping for court, all these things that are just like, you don't think that that's what goes into caring for a child, but it does when they're in this position.
Yep. Yeah. Such great advice. I think, you know, just having your eyes open to people around you. I think, you know, a lot of us that maybe didn't grow up even knowing about foster care or, you know, knowing kids that were in foster care, I guarantee you know somebody around you that is either experiencing it now or knows somebody who is. And if you don't, reach out to my team at Show Up. We can connect you with the organizations that are doing a lot of this work. But again, we're going to make this really intentional when we're coming to you as a business. Frankly, if you own a business, there are so many ways that we can get involved. I have to say, like Entrada, I just have to do a shout out to Entrada.
Yeah.
Because our friends, Adam and those guys at Entrada, they've been doing a lot around these Sunday suppers.
Yes.
And our friends from the University of Utah, our football teams and our athletic teams, our volleyball teams, our Red Rocks, BYU players, they've really gotten involved in helping these Sunday suppers happen. Just a meal for those families that can come. They can just sit and visit with other families going through the same situation.
Yes.
So we've been really proud of some of our business partners. But again, reach out if there's anything that you're ready to get involved in.
Yeah, one of the best things that I did in Boise in my time there is creating a support group once a month for foster families. And it's so easily, it can be easily done anywhere. And I know my faith community has talked about opening up their space monthly for something like that. And just providing a space for like-minded individuals. You know, it's really easy to find like everyone in the world who goes through certain things. And for some reason, even someone who was in foster care myself, it is so hard to find other people involved in foster care.
Yeah.
Until you ask, you know, until you ask and either they are or they know someone who is or something like that. So just network, network, network.
Yep.
Find those people. It takes a village. It takes a village for your own kids and it takes a village for foster kids and really coming around them as a community.
Yep. And I love the mentoring piece of stuff you're doing because I think that's that one caring adult that we've talked about before.
Yes.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here with us.
Yes, it was
love
so
it.
Fun. Okay. It was
Thanks,
so
Lizzie.
Fun. Thank you.
You can find more information at utahfostercare.org as well as our website, showuputah.org. Thanks for being a friend.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless. And I will never understand it. I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.